Podcasting from the Deep Sage 9 Observatory in the high desert near Taos, New Mexico, this is the Deep Sage 9 Starcast. Welcome to the Starcast for the week of June 29th, 2025. I'm your host, Jay Schaefer, and with me is co-host Mike Lewinsky. Let's take a look at space weather from spaceweather.com. Mike, what's happening with the sun over the next couple days?
Well, there are some sunspots out on the disk of the sun facing the Earth, but they are all stable and quiet. There are no solar flares expected for the next 24 hours, and the possibility of geomagnetic storms is very low. We get to maybe a 20% chance of active conditions in the next day, and the conditions are only smaller, down to a 1% chance of a severe storm. So we're not expecting to see any northern lights here at mid-latitudes.
Oh, okay. Well, that means I can stop aiming my camera north and aim it south to catch the beautiful Milky Way now. So tonight, if you look west to the west at the crescent moon, you should be able to see a little red dot that is Mars. And they're very close together, only about a degree apart, depending where you are in the U.S. And so if you want to see Mars and the moon together, kind of look up toward the west and find the crescent moon around 9 tonight, and you should be able to see, pick out Mars as well. And with the moon being just a sliver, this is one of the best times that you can see the Milky Way. And of course, you know, if you want to get to a non-light polluted area, this is the time of the year where you can see the stretch of the Milky Way that includes the Cygnus star cloud, which is one of the most star-rich regions in the night sky. And when we look towards Cygnus, we're looking downstream through the local arm of our galaxy, which is called the Orion arm of the galaxy. And we're looking toward the core of a galaxy, toward the actual black hole that is in the center of the galaxy in the constellation Sagittarius. So those are kind of the main events in the night sky this week. There was a couple of pretty interesting events in the news this week. First, there was images released from the new Rubin Observatory, and then there was the fireball meteor with meteorites in the southeastern United States. On June 26, approximately 12:25 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, a bright daytime fireball streaked across the sky, culminating in a thunderous explosion southeast of Atlanta, Georgia. The American Meteor Society, or AMS, was flooded with over 200 reports from 20 different states as people witnessed this dazzling object moving from north-northeast to south-southwest. Mike Hanke, the AMS operations manager, noted that many instruments recorded it, the fall, including the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration satellites, and Doppler radars, and even some of our All-Sky 7 cameras. Shortly after the sonic boom that many people heard, a resident in McDonough, Georgia, about 30 miles south of Atlanta, had a truly out-of-this-world experience. A golf ball-sized rock punched right through their roof, through the ceiling, and landed on their floor. And thankfully, nobody was hurt. And this quickly drew the attention of meteorite hunters from around the U.S. who were on the lookout for what they sometimes call charcoal briquettes. This term refers to the fresh, black, and thin fusion crust that forms over the newly fallen meteorites during their fiery descent through the atmosphere. And if they weren't disappointed, Stephen Dixie of Atlanta was on the scene the very same day and successfully recovered two beautiful stony meteorites from this incredible event. So this was a meteorite hunter's dream day. And of course, A lot of people in the research community would rather that they meteorite hunters would turn the meteorites over to the universities, but there is some money to be made from hunting meteorites. So, Mike, what's happening with the new Rubin Observatory?
Yeah, Jay, the Rubin Observatory released their first batch of images during a online live stream event this past Monday. Images from the new telescope included the Trifid and Lagoon nebulas and the Virgo cluster of galaxies. The observatory also announced discovery of about 2,100 asteroids, including seven near-Earth asteroids never seen before. None of those pose any risk to the Earth, but it's going to continue to catalog new asteroids. So these images in the June 23rd first look event are just the beginning. Every three nights for the next decade, the fast-moving and highly sensitive telescope will complete a scan of the Southern Hemisphere sky, generating 60 million gigabytes of data. And processing that much data is going to require the use of AI. And we'll talk a little bit more about AI and astronomy in the next segment. But the telescope is named for the astronomer Vera Rubin, who is well known for discovering firm evidence for dark matter. And the observatory is going to generate survey images consisting of exposures of 15 or 30 seconds using six filters to cover the full visible range, as well as near-infrared wavelengths. So when these events hit the media, they're often sensationalized. And as they filter through social media, they become even more sensationalized and oftentimes deceptive. So this week, our discussion of the podcast is junk AI images, misinformation, and exaggeration about astro events.
Yeah, and I think this is particularly aggravating for more seasoned observers that this information, gets eaten up by novices who can't really discern, some science facts from some of these kind of exaggerations and deceptions.
Yeah, and it's become its own mini economy. The AI slop, as it's called in general, and with space news and astronomy photos in particular, people have learned that they can post sensationalized and exaggerated photos and generate a lot of engagement and start to monetize their following. And so the incentives are upside down here. The real images are not going to compete with the most highly creative generative AI that can create things that simply don't exist. And so those are the things that attract the most attention, the most likes, the most comments. And it is a very, like I say, upside down incentives that favor the fake and the sensational over the real. And we start to lose our appreciation for what's real.
Yeah, I've noticed particularly on social media that, a lot of these accounts, you can, if you kind of keep a close eye on, what the account is, so there's an account, for example, it's called Our Amazing Universe, and there's no name attributed to it, and it spews out, bunches of AI images and AI headlines. And for example, here's a couple of three or four from last week that I noticed on social media. So there was a account called In Times News, and had a big AI image with hundreds of meteors, falling with the Milky Way in the background, and kind of the sunset image, where there was kind of red glow on the horizon. And the headline was "Booted Meteors Pelt Alaska," as shown in this image. And so some of the other ones that I saw, you know, one relating to the fireball, the Georgia fireball, was meteor burning over Metro Atlanta, and it showed, you know, the skyline of Atlanta with a you know, a world-ending size meteor image on there. And then another one was fireball slams into Georgia home. And so, you know, and then relating to it, there was a comet that's way out still. I mean, it's a very large comet. It's what we commonly call it, Comet BB, and it's still way out beyond Neptune. But you know, the scientists were seeing some exploding jets coming from this comet, and so the sensational headline was "Mega Exploding Comet Headed Towards Sun." And so, and the exaggeration, of course, is that this comet won't even, you know, come within like 9 AUs of the Earth. And although it is, you know, huge, it's just, and it's not going to get close to the sun until 2031, you know, that, but they had to make this, you know, big, this is going to end the Earth type of headline. So what have you seen recently, or you know, what are some of the more memorable deceptions that you've heard about or seen?
Yeah, of course, we don't need AI to create deception. And, you know, one of the most classic and memorable composite images that was clearly faked showed a very thin crescent moon, and there were stars inside of the crescent. So somebody had taken that, you know, with a mask and made a mask of the crescent and then popped it into a star-filled sky with just zero understanding of what the, you know, actual appearance of a crescent moon is and what the structure is. I also saw an image that had, it was a star trail photo, so either a long exposure or a stack of long exposures. And the star trails in the water of the lake that were reflected were all distorted by the currents, but they were distorted in a way that, you know, the person who had made the composite or made the AI slop, you know, did not understand that this was a long exposure. And so the ripples of the currents had nice curved star trails that, you know, would curve back and forth in a snake-like pattern that simply could not happen. It was as if you'd taken the long exposure of 4 hours and then assumed that that was produced instantaneously and that the reflected image and the ripples in the water would perfectly distort all of the star trails. So sometimes it's just really obvious that an image has been altered, and sometimes less so. And I find, you know, my skepticism is so heightened these days that I'm reluctant to engage with anything that looks too perfect. And I know that some of what I see that's too perfect is just the result of very talented astrophotographers doing what they do best. But I don't want to inadvertently bolster visibility by interacting, liking, commenting. I mean, you know, I think the worst thing that we can do with obvious AI slop is to comment on it, because that's the interaction that they're trying to drive. Even a negative comment of "this is fake" puts it in front of more people's eyes. And so by trying to debunk, we inadvertently monetize their product for them. And so I've kind of switched to a whitelist approach of, these are reputable astrophotographers who I have followed for many, many years. And I see them complaining about their work being used as the basis for generative AI. And often they will post side by side, "this is my photo from such and such a date and such a place." And then the generative AI that has ripped off their work without attribution, which is so clearly by the basis of landscape features and even much of the image. In some cases, you know, they took what was an amazing image and made it over the top amazing. And looking at the AI slop, it's not clear. In a standalone context, not at all clear that this is fake. But I do, give more credence to those photographers who are seeking out and finding or having reported to them derivative ripoff slop. And so those are the astrophotographers I preferentially follow and boost, you know.
Yeah, and I think there's a legitimacy to where legitimate astrophotographers like you and I would venture to say, where we annotate our photos with the context of where it was taken and what direction we were facing, whatever our camera settings were. And even a lot of these astrophotographers who do composite images, and there's good reason to do some of this compositing, where they will actually annotate in their post with the image to say, this was a stack of 15 Milky Way images, and then I added the foreground with a different exposure but taken on the same night from the same location, or they may even say I composited this. This was a composite image of the full moon that I had to, take the exposure of the full moon down, quite a bit to composite it into so that you could see stars in the background behind a full moon or something like that. And as long as they're kind of honest about that and, forthcoming, I think that is good for the community and good for education and, good for novices wanting to, be excited about the universe. But I think on the other hand is when we see these AI slop and generative AI images, they raise these expectations, beyond realistic levels for novices. And it leads to a lot of times of them being either, dismissive of real images or underwhelmed and therefore lose interest in, the night sky and astronomy. And what's been your experience with that, Mike?
Yeah, I think even our, traditional craft of astrophotography poses that risk of, the camera sees so much more than the naked eye. And if people are accustomed to looking at legitimate, real photos of the universe, the experience of going outside at night, and thinking, oh, well, I live in a city, I just can't see that, it's too bright here. But then you get out into a dark sky area and you still do not see the level of detail and certainly almost none of the color that is apparent in a photograph. And so I periodically make the effort to post, a side by side. This is what my naked eye can see, and this is what my camera can see. And it's a difference of, a few milliseconds of photons entering my eye versus, 15 to 30 seconds of photons entering the camera sensor. And so the technology gives us the ability to appreciate the universe in a new way. But I think we do have a responsibility to periodically remind our audience that the camera is so much more sensitive that you're not going to see this. And that's not a reason to not look up. It's get excited to go out and do the viewing and have reasonable expectations of what's possible.
Yeah. And, for example, when we look at the Rubin Observatory images, I was looking at the Trifid and Lagoon Nebula images that were released from the Rubin Observatory. And, that they were just brilliant, with all this detail in the nebular clouds and a wide variety of colors. And what a lot of people don't realize is, number one, it was a longer exposure and probably a composite exposure where, multiple exposures of, 15 to 30 seconds. But they were also using, when we talked about those six filters earlier, when we were talking about the telescope, is those filters are, bringing out the best light of, the best, filtering out the strongest photons in a particular frequency, which may or may not be in our visible light spectrum for our human eyes. A lot of those images that you see of nebula and deep space objects will have, stuff that our eyes could never see, with a lot of infrared material, and that is basically compressed into our visual scale.
That's right. And, on this topic of how much information or how much, light there is out there, I think it's important to make a distinction for the truly beneficial uses of AI in astronomy. There's an article last May in the MIT Technology Review talking about the Square Kilometer Array Observatory. They are placing hundreds of thousands of dishes and antennas in deserts across Australia and South Africa. That's going to be generating some 300 petabytes of data a year. And one of the computational astrophysicists quoted in this article, Cecilia Garafo, says, when you have too much data and you don't have the technology to process it, it's like having no data. And as I was, thinking about our topic today and doing a little reading, I recalled Vannevar Bush's paradox. And Vannevar Bush was instrumental in the creation of the National Science Foundation, which was established by an act of Congress in 1950. But in the years preceding that, he had an article in The Atlantic where he lamented that specialization was causing a proliferation of information. He says there's a growing mountain of research, but we are bogged down and we can no longer grasp, much less remember, all of these observations and conclusions. And so the paradox here is that as information proliferates, our ability to access relevant and accurate information diminishes in proportion. And of course, he was worried about this in 1945. The article is excellent. It describes a device that sounds very much like a web browser. When you read his description, it was, visionary. And he definitely anticipated a lot of our modern technology as needed, as the only way that we would be able to manage this mass of data. And, I think of what despair he might have when he could see that this, has resulted in not just, a staggering volume of scientific data, but an even greater volume of misinformation generated by people who just want to make a quick buck and who, can use generative AI to create thousands and thousands and thousands of permutations of news articles and images in the hopes that one or two of them catch on and become viral. And they don't need to tune anything. They're just brute forcing reality, as it were, by saturating the information environment with so much that sooner or later they're going to hit something that happens to catch people's attention. I've heard it said, well, AI is going to save us from AI. We're going to develop new tools to sort through all this slop. But we really seem to be locked into what the biologists call the Red Queen's race, where every innovation by the scammers requires more technology to filter it out. And then in turn, the scammers adjust their algorithms and add more resources that in turn require us to adjust our defenses. And the end result is that we're locked in a perpetual arms race where there are no winners.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but it was just, I was just discussing this last night about anti-plagiarism software for when I was teaching at college, is that was, just when AI was starting to really become a thing. And of course, and this became an arms race between the faculty and the students between their AI generated papers and our anti-plagiarism. And so, you know, when you're talking about that kind of arms race, that's the exact same kind of thing that's going on in academia with, you know, just, you know, writing, you know, basic papers and students. And I, but, you know, and I agree with you that there's, you know, there's a lot of use for AI within astronomy. And, you know, I'm, we're not talking about dissing AI in general. And, you know, like, you know, I was reading an article about an AI framework that's called the SimBig, and it's a simulation inference of galaxies, and it's it actually is trying to simulate entire universes. And so they basically will, the AI model will, you know, generate these simulated universes from the what it's learned about, you know, cosmological parameters, and then it basically uses some of our noise from our actual observed universe and applies it to these artificial universes, and so this is pushing forward cosmological research. And so, you know, so
yeah, that's right. And,
you know, go ahead.
It's all they're purpose built tools. This isn't just we're going to throw some papers into ChatGPT and have it solve, you know, the mystery of dark energy by any means, but by utilizing, you know, astronomical computational science and writing specialized applications to process data, we are getting benefits from so-called AI.
Yeah, and also one of the things that I need to talk about is just the even mainstream media is that and I started my career early in my career was in broadcasting, and there was always, you know, at the end of a newscast there's what we call the fluff segment, and this is basically if they need to make use some time at the end of a newscast and they don't have a story to fill it and they need to stretch it just a little bit, there's these rip and read basically news stories, you know, and they're always, you know, and of course, you know, astronomy and scientists will put out these news releases, but they'll be kind of, you know, written in such a way that they could be, you know, misinterpreted or sensationalized. And so sometimes, you know, like I'll be tuning between news channels and I'll see the same story, you know, on almost verbatim word for word, where these newscasters, you know, we call rip and read these, you know, press releases. And, you know, and I remember one back, I think it was about 2016, and it was somehow it got sensationalized that there was going to be a super Mars and the Mars was going to be bigger and brighter than the moon. And that's, and that got picked up by media. And the way that the, you know, kind of the original press release was, you know, it was a crescent moon and, you know, definitely the dimmest that a moon could possibly be. So, and it was also the apogee of Mars, which made it as close to us as it possibly could be and as large as it could possibly be. But of course it was much, 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 much smaller, you know, than the moon would have been. And, you know, and I had actually people coming up to me, you know, are you getting your telescope out tonight to see the moon, you know, see the Mars as big as the moon? Can we look? And so, you know, sometimes you'll see these stories in mainstream media as well. And so, and, you know, and they, and I don't think they intentionally exaggerate. I think it's just more of that they're not knowledgeable enough to discern whether, you know, they are exaggerating.
I think you're right. And it certainly points to a need for higher quality, better educated, more science journalism.
Yeah, and you know, as far as the mainstream media goes, or your local your local news goes, is that often the only scientist in the room is the meteorologist, and so they're the person that basically talks about space and astro events, and that's a great thing, and I think that meteorologists are doing a great job, but it's again, people kind of just look at it the same way that they look at the at the weather forecast. Is they might be right 50% of the time,
Right.
So what do we, I know for you've pretty much are weaning yourself away from social media altogether. And I think I respect you for that a great deal. I'm still, unfortunately, pretty addicted to kind of Facebook, Instagram, and of course we're both on Blue Sky and that sort of thing. So what do you think the kind of solution, or what can some people actually do to kind of help themselves discern what is real?
It's a great question, and there are not really simple answers to it. I mentioned earlier that I've kind of whitelisted a certain set of astrophotographers that I've been following, and landscape photographers and other photographers that I've been following for years now, and whose work I trust, who have too much investment in their craft and their credibility and their art to use generative AI. Of course, many of us do use tools for denoising that are based on AI in some way. It's not to say that there's zero use of it, but it's not to create something that is unreal or didn't happen. But for somebody who doesn't already have that whitelist built, it can be really difficult. I think that sticking with reputable organizations that are doing the vetting for you, then that could be from International Dark Sky, it could be from university astronomy programs. Certainly, getting out there, as we talked about last week, getting out to a star party, and just looking through telescope yourself, so you start to build up some real-world experience. I was in Mesa Verde National Park this past week, and there was a presentation given in the amphitheater at the campground titled Ancestral Skies. And at the conclusion of that presentation, we went up into the parking lot, and they had a couple telescopes set up, and people took turns looking through the telescopes, with the rangers giving a bit of a tour using laser pointers and pointing out, we're looking over there at, Hercules, and here's the cluster. And so I think getting some field experience and not completely relying anymore on what we see in social media, just being skeptical. I think you can, start to discern the pages that don't have clear attribution of authorship of photographers who are consistently posting these absolutely unreal images when every post is just over the top. You've got somebody who's farming engagement, who's just there to make money, and they don't care about truth. They don't care about presenting reality as it is. They only care about engagement. So block them. Block and report. Don't interact. Don't like. Don't dislike. Don't laugh or poke fun at. Just get away.
Or block. Yeah, I block. But and then also, like, I'm a moderator, or you know, I guess a resident expert in some of these groups, astronomy groups on Facebook. Like, for example, we have a group called Tau Sky Watchers, and I remember when you were down here, is you used to be a contributor and moderator there, and basically a resident skeptic. And so I kind of monitor some of these groups that are local, where people are seeing things like weather balloons or a meteor or reentry, and going, what is this? And kind of like chiming into the group and saying, well, if we've got a time and we've got a vector where you were looking, and a good photo of it, we can look at like satellite databases and say, that was a satellite, or that was a satellite reentry, or that was a rocket launch, or and I don't know how many times people have seen Starlink trains for the first time with their naked eye and going, oh my God, alien invasion, and being on some of these groups and being able to, kind of be the resident skeptic, or as I call myself, the over expectation manager for some of these groups. But, so that's kind of some of the things that I'm doing. And of course, that brings us back to this podcast. And so, kind of its raison d'être is that so that we can, help novices navigate, what the information about our universe.
Yeah, this is so desperately needed.
Okay, so why don't we go ahead and wrap up today, and we want to thank all of our listeners for checking out the podcast. Please be sure to comment, like, subscribe, and let us know what you'd like to hear more about or less about. And you can also check out our individual websites. Mike's is wildernessvagabonds.com, and mine is skylapser.com. Our intro music is Fanfare for Space by Kevin MacLeod from the YouTube Audio Library. From the Deep Space Nine Observatory, this is Jay Schaefer, and
this is Mike Lewinsky,
wishing you all clear skies.